Good Monday afternoon and welcome to Meet Me at the Diner with host Ann Eller. Today's special guest is State Superintendent of Education, Mick Zace. Now coming to you live from Sharp Facets Gallery, here is your host, Ann Eller.
Oh, that's right. We are here today. And yes, we have Mick Zace, Superintendent of Schools. How are you doing today, Mick?
Doing fine, Ann. Thank you for having me on today.
Well, that it is education, of course, is on everybody's mind. It's a big part of the budget, and we just thought we could maybe get some input as to what is going on there. Now, I know one of the things that's going on is, I understand in February, you're actually going to go in and ask for a waiver to not have to deal with No Child Left Behind.
You're absolutely right, Ann. No Child Left Behind is a federal law that says by 2015, every child in every category has to be proficient in every subject. And obviously that's a noble goal, but an unrealistic goal. There are 36 different categories of where you can either meet standards or not meet standards, and a school that gets 35 of those meets the standard in 35 categories, but just misses one is declared an unsatisfactory or failing school. And that's deceiving to the parents, and frankly, it's very demoralizing to the education professionals who work so hard every day. And just another example of how excessive federal intrusion has unintended consequences. So we're going to submit to the U.S. Department of Education our request to opt out of the provisions of No Child Left Behind, and we'll do that in February.
Well, that seems like that's a lot of different areas to concentrate on, when in truth, one of the biggest problems that we seem to have is with reading and getting all our students up to speed in the, what, first grade, second grade, third grade, because I understand there's a big problem when they get behind. It's very hard for them to ever get caught up.
Well, and not all subjects are created equal, and the single most important subject in school is reading. But we have a system that's focused on seat time rather than mastery. So, you know, we've got bells and they ring every hour or every 50 minutes, and it sometimes we don't allocate enough time to reading. We teach reading in kindergarten through third grade, and after that, reading is not taught. So kids learn to read in those years, and then from grades 4 to 12, they read to learn. So if you enter fourth grade and you can't read on grade level, you're going to fall farther and farther behind every year. Sadly, and 38% of South Carolina's fourth graders are functionally illiterate. Should we be surprised then that 5, 6, and 7 years later they drop out of school? The simple fact is those 38% cannot understand their math text, their science book, or their social studies assignment. Not because they're not very bright, it's simply they can't read because they didn't learn it in grades kindergarten through three. We have got to make sure that our fourth graders are reading on grade level by the time they move into fourth grade.
Well, that brings me to another question. I know you are a military man. If memory serves me correct, you went to West Point.
Correct.
And my husband went to West Point, and he says that the method in the military is more important than the actual teacher. That if you have a good method, you can take anybody and make them learn how to do what needs to be done.
Well, that's a popular perception, but people keep looking for the silver bullet in programs, and the fact of the matter is that a good teacher is far more important than a good program. And there are enormous differences in teacher effectiveness, and we pretty much have standard programs across the state. A teacher in the top 20% will impart, on average, a year and a half of learning in one academic year, and a teacher in the bottom 20% only 6 months of learning in one academic year. a threefold difference in effectiveness based on what students learn. Fact is, the differences in teachers are far greater than the differences in schools. So your child is far better off in a failing school with a great teacher than in a great school with a mediocre teacher. And the cheapest and most effective way for us to improve educational outcomes is to improve the quality of our teachers and the principals for whom they work.
Well, how do you go about doing that, Mick? I mean, everybody pretty much goes to college to become a teacher. There's a curriculum. They practice. They student teach. How do you do that?
Well, the number one way that you do that is the way you maintain standards in any other profession, and that is you hold people accountable for results, which is why one of our top legislative priorities moving into the coming general session of the General Assembly is that we pass a pay-for-performance plan that evaluates teachers on how much their students learn and, frankly, evaluates principals on how effective their teachers are. And a lot of pushback, but right now we pay teachers based on their credentials, their experience, and what kind of degree they have, a bachelor's, a master's, or a doctorate. But after 5 years, experience has little or no impact on effectiveness. Credentials, and in particular board certification, has no impact on teacher effectiveness. And all of the research confirms that teachers with bachelor's degrees are just as effective with teachers with master's degrees or doctorates. So we want to move to a system where excellent teaching is recognized and rewarded, and frankly, that our ineffective teachers are no longer in the classroom. And it's just not me saying this. In the most recent State of the Union address, the President of the United States said, after the man and woman standing at the front of the classroom, the single most important aspect of a child's education, or after the home environment, the man or the woman standing at the front of the classroom is the single most important component of a child's education. We want to reward our best teachers and stop making excuses for the bad ones. And that was the president. So that's what we have to do, Ann, is hold teachers accountable and provide incentives to those who are excellent teachers.
Now, to do that, though, Mick, doesn't that have to go something in front of the state legislature? And how long a process, and how far are you along on developing that process?
Well, we have a rough draft of a pay-for-performance plan that I've reviewed and that our staff has put together. Within the next 3 or 4 weeks, we will be rolling that out to various groups of teachers, principals, and superintendents for their review and input. And after we've had a chance to get input from educators in the field, then we'll take that to our State Board of Education. And we hope to have it ready by January when the General Assembly reconvenes.
Well, then that would have to go in front of the state legislature as something for them to take up, correct?
Absolutely.
Because that would change how they were being paid. But how do you implement a system like this?
Well, you have to implement it carefully. But, I mean, you have to have a transition period, and you have to explain it so everybody knows what the new rules of the game are. And, obviously, you have a whole new compensation system for our teachers and principals.
One of the things
that I think that we need to do is we've got shortage areas of teachers. We've got a shortage of special education teachers, chemistry teachers, physics teachers, calculus teachers. We need to reward those low areas or those areas where we have teacher shortages and provide incentives for those for people to go into those fields.
So if I'm a teacher and I've been in the system for 20 years, and now maybe I'm not as effective as a teacher as I should be, could I be making less money?
You conceivably could. That's right. And we're going to reward people based on the quality of the job they do, not how long they've been in the classroom.
So this isn't going to be like Social Security where I've got mine already.
Well, no, I mean it doesn't make sense. We've got teachers, Ann, who shouldn't be in the classroom. They do a disservice to our children because our children don't learn under their care. They are a detriment, and we need to make sure that they're held accountable.
Well, I know we all know of teachers that we felt that in the classroom we never learned anything.
And we've got some wonderful teachers.
Absolutely.
And I think all of your listeners can think back onto the teachers who made a difference in their lives. And it's not necessarily the teachers that we liked the most.
Sure.
But certainly it was the teachers who got down to business, were available to help us after class, who could explain things in two or three different ways very clearly, who were able to convey to the students that they cared about the students. You know, there's a truism in education that students don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that's an essential ingredient, is teachers have got to care about their kids. They just can't be, they show up, go through the motions, and then leave at the end of the day.
You know, you've been in office, what, 9-10 months now since the first part of January.
Mm-hmm.
How have things been going?
Well, I think they've been going fairly well. I've spent a lot of time traveling the state, one or two days a week. I go out and I visit with schools and talk to teachers and principals and visit with superintendents and other staff people and hear their views. And we've got some great schools and some professionals who are working very hard around the state. And we've got schools at the other end, and we've got everything in between. I don't know if your viewers or listeners know that South Carolina's academic magnet school in Charleston was selected by U.S. News and World Report as the number one academic magnet school in the nation.
Wow.
We got some great schools, and they're all different kinds. We've got charter schools and magnet schools and online schools and Montessori schools and military schools and arts-infused and math, science, and engineering, and technology-focused, and career-focused, and which really brings home the notion that one size does not fit all in education. You know, our children differ enormously in their abilities, the rates at which they mature, their interests, their skill set, their personalities, their home environment. Yet our traditional school system puts every child in the same classroom, expects them to learn the same material on the same schedule, which is why I think it's important that parents are able to choose from a menu of options when they're choosing a school that's the right fit for their children. And we have a lot of these springing up across the state that have a specific tailored focus or curriculum so that students and parents can find that best match.
Well, I think that is terrific, and of course the charter schools, and of course there's been a lot of question on how much money these charter schools should get. Mick, what is your feeling on this?
My feeling is that we should fund students, not organizations, and that the dollar should follow the child, and that that should be the principle. And if a child is going to an online school or a charter school, and the charter schools, let me emphasize, are public schools, or a public single-gender program or a public Montessori program, the dollar should follow the child. That's what the taxpayers want to fund. They want to fund students, not big bureaucratic organizations. And I've said for a long time, we spend far too much money on facilities and administration and not nearly enough on teachers and the classroom. You know, if you've got a great teacher who knows her material and loves the children, you can have a great school in a tent, but...
Well, they used to teach them that way, didn't they, Mick?
Well, they did, and I had one gentleman from the subcontinent of India said, you know, in India, our best schools are not as good as your worst schools in America, but it's not a facility that makes the difference. You know, a building never hugged a child, and rare is the administrator who teaches one. And there's never been a documented case of a school turnaround without the presence of a dynamic principal and a cadre of excellent teachers. And that's what we have to invest in, dynamic principals and excellent teachers. We're getting ready to spend $125 million to build a high school in this state. And I just keep thinking, you know, we ought to be spending some of that money on teachers, not these beautiful, elaborate monuments to the school board that we tend to erect.
I couldn't agree with you more. We do spend a lot on that. But do you think that by changing this pay for performance that you can turn some of the teachers that have not been stellar teachers into better teachers?
I think we can do that, and I think that we'll make it easier for principals and superintendents to remove the ineffective teachers. You know, I had an interesting experience earlier this week, or last weekend. I was talking to a group of first-year assistant principals, and I was discussing the pay for performance and one plan, and I said, we really do want to reward our best teachers and, frankly, make it easier for administrators to remove the least effective teachers from the classroom. I got applause at that. I think that was the only applause line I got, and I certainly wasn't trying to get applause. I was just explaining. So it was the assistant principals who said, were saying, Dr. Zase, we absolutely, as administrators, need to make it easier to remove those ineffective teachers. You know, the teachers know who the good teachers are.
Sure.
And so do the principals.
Sure. Well, I think it's like any other profession. Sometimes we have teachers that start out great, and they don't persist or they don't grow with the job.
Well, you're right. You know, we're teaching a lot of them how to use the technology. Their students all know how to use the technology, and their students are used to learning from the technology. Again, I go back to the point that after the home environment, the teacher and the principal are the most important things in education. We need to focus on those two.
Now, Mick, what about this, $36 million that the federal government is looking to withhold because you didn't spend enough on special education?
Yes, this is another example of federal intrusion into the matters of the state. This was money for special needs children. It's called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And the act says that a state may not reduce the number of dollars spent on special education. Well, 3 years ago, our General Assembly and our state had a tough financial year, and so the state reduced funding for special education. The federal government's solution to this is to cut our federal funding by $36 million, not just for 1 year, but in perpetuity. You know, so instead of penalizing the state, they're penalizing our most vulnerable students. And we are appealing that ruling to the state or to the federal Department of Education, and if necessary, we will pursue remedy in the courts.
But now, when will that be coming around? Because that could affect your budget for next year. Is that correct?
That's correct. And if we don't hear from the U.S. Department of Education soon, and we're going to have to take it to the next level.
The next level. How does Governor Haley feel about the direction you're trying to take things?
I think Governor Haley and I have a very close working relationship. Even before the two of us were sworn into office, we met to ensure that we were pretty much on the same sheet of music in the direction that we were going, and we're working closely together. We've divided up responsibilities for different parts of the education reform agenda, and I've got responsibility for things like pay for performance and expanding the menu of options that are available to parents and students so they can find an educational environment and course of study that fits their needs. She's got the lead in looking at alternatives to one statewide bus system, and she's also has the lead for trying to reform our state public school funding system, which, to tell you the truth, Ann, is arcane. There are 82 different pots or sources of state money that are coming to our school districts, and a lot of times our principals and superintendents are not able to move dollars from one pot to the next to meet the areas of greatest need. But, you know, one school may need after-school tutors. Another may need computers and technology. Another may need textbooks, and another may need a new roof. But those are all different pots of money for teachers, technology, textbooks, and facilities. And we need to provide more latitude to our local education officials to spend the dollars they have to meet their areas of greatest need, rather than trying to control that from Columbia, which is what we do with our present funding laws.
Now, Mick, one of the things I can't remember, I know I talked to you when you were getting running for the office, but have you gone in and done a audit of how money is spent all in that department, or are you going to set up to do one?
We're in the process of hiring some auditors. When I first came in and we recommended a new budget to the General Assembly, we recommended $107 million in cost savings and recommended cost savings of 15% in our own South Carolina Department of Education budget. We've restructured our offices, and in doing so, we've reduced our staff level at this point by around 50 people. So we are working very hard to save the taxpayers' dollars and to invest it in the classroom where we get the biggest return on the investment.
Well, that's good to hear. So you're working on saving money down there in Columbia, too.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm talking about, the 100, both in my own office and across the state. You know, we don't have a shortage of programs. You know, our biggest area of need is in quality teachers and quality principals, and that's where we want to focus our resources.
Well, that's good to hear, and you also want to get it back more on the local level, if I'm understanding what you're saying.
Absolutely. We got too much direction and control coming out of Washington, as I've talked about today, and frankly, too much control and decision-making coming out of Columbia. You know, what works in an affluent suburban school may not be appropriate for a poor rural school, and vice versa. Yet, both from the State Department of Education and from our General Assembly, well-meaning people make policies and statutes that are a one-size-fits-all. And in every instance, they either tell our education officials what they must do or may not do, and in every instance they limit the decision-making authority of our principals, superintendents, and teachers. Frankly, they also limit the decision-making authority of parents who want to choose a school or educational environment or course of study that fits the needs, aspirations, and ability level of their child.
Well, you know, I think this is refreshing to hear, Mick, and I know that I hope we can call you again and have you back on maybe after the first of the year and see how the progress is going.
I'd be happy to, Ann. It's a pleasure talking with you and your listeners.
All right. Thanks so much. That's Superintendent of Schools, Mick Zais, right there down in Columbia. Thanks so much, Mick.
Thank you, Ann. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.